Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Alice Anderson, author of Some Bright Morning, I'll Fly Away, a memoir. We'll also talk with Mike Strecker, whose new books are The Young Comics Guide to Telling Jokes, Books 1 and 2. One of my favorite sayings comes from the poet Muriel Rukeyser. Here it is. What would happen if one woman told the truth about her life? The world would split open. I often think about that when I read memoirs, especially ones like Alice Anderson's Some Bright Morning I'll Fly Away. It is filled with so much truth, so much pain, and so much beauty. In this book, we visit the many worlds of one woman's life, a stint in Paris as a fashion model, an acclaimed poet, teacher, a woman struggling to survive sexual abuse by her father, then later her husband, all the while struggling to preserve the very lives of her three children, her sweet three, as she calls them. It is a fierce, powerful, beautiful book. Alice Anderson, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Now, your story begins where, I have to say, so many stories began in those early days post-Katrina, when you were trying to get back to your home in Ocean Springs, Mississippi. And since then, you've left the marriage, moved out of your miraculously saved home, you're hanging out in a FEMA trailer, and you're learning how to shoot a gun.
Yes, that is how it begins. In fact, while I didn't write this book in order, I was a poet, and I, frankly, had no idea what I was doing writing a memoir. So what I did when I started to write this book is I wrote scenes, moments that I knew were a story I wanted to tell, and that was the first one I wrote, and it ended up being the opening of the book.
And there's a fair amount of New Orleans in this book, too, as it's a place you know very well.
Absolutely. Living in Ocean Springs, New Orleans was a great enticement to just head over down the coast every weekend and spend a weekend, as my sweet three used to call it, in the city. And especially after the storm, of course, the Mississippi Gulf Coast took a direct hit. And, you know, it's hard for people to remember now, but, you know, months after the storm, we still didn't have a grocery that had refrigeration in it. So especially after the storm, we started going over to New Orleans every weekend. It was a kind of escape. And we'd have this beautiful weekend in the quarter, and then we'd stock up on groceries and other items, and we'd head back into the devastation that was the Mississippi Gulf Coast.
Now, this story is such an amazing one. There's the poet Alice, there's the Southern wife and mother Alice, there's the survivor Alice, the California girl, and now it seems it's the triumphant Alice.
Thank you for saying that. My intention for this book really was the same intention I have when I'm writing poems. Somebody once told me that I was a redemption addict, the poet Tom Lux, who is my teacher at Sarah Lawrence. And what he meant by that is no matter how ugly, no matter how painful, no matter how down in the dirt whatever I was writing about was, I was still going to search in the end for the silver lining, for the redemption. And we sort of have arrived at the silver lining redemption in our lives now.
And so well deserved after such a struggle. I mean, so much of this book is practically a legal thriller. I mean, this is a story of what seems like an endless struggle to protect your kids, first and foremost. And legal battles didn't always go your way, even though it seemed quite clear they should.
No, they absolutely did not. When I first filed for divorce following a brutal attack, I think of myself then and how naive I was, that things were very clear-cut and very clear, and justice would be served, and we would go on into the sunset. What I didn't know is how long it would take for that sun to set, and definitely the world of family court and then criminal court is not always what a protective mother expects it to be.
And another thing about this book that amazes me is how much it is the story of a woman's body, literally the life of a woman's body. You know, there are scenes where you're flying through the air off a motorcycle, where you're flying down the stairs when your husband pushes you from behind. And then later you've been racked by traumatic brain injury, abused again and again. I keep thinking of that necklace of bruises around your neck. It's as if you brought all that poetic skill of yours to that part of your life as well.
Exactly. It is a story about the body and about, you know, not just how the body is abused, but how the body and reclaiming it is what saves you. I think about that scene in Paris where I jump through the plate glass window. You know, sometimes the body has to endure in order to get to the other side. And this is really good. I hadn't thought of it that way. That's a very good observation about the book.
Oh, well, I wonder if you'd read the very opening of your book about what happens to our scars, because I think that's so evocative of the story you're telling.
I would be happy to. Prologue. We make chapels of our scars. They cross our skin and soul, a topographic map of the past. Our scars are built on the delicate yet dazzling scaffolding holding our weary, ragtag hearts aloft. I have in me a scar where my childhood sits, made up of playground songs and the raised red slap of despair inside the slate-blue, cloudless, empty spot between my ribs. In me, there is a scar made of Paris nights so bright, plum black and terrifying, my legs striding cobbled streets towards something, anything that doesn't look like disaster. In me, I have a wedding scar, pasted on with disappointment, made of that sinking feeling of not knowing if you do, the moment before the moment you are required to say, I do, and do. There is a childbirth scar born of the one who came and left at once in blood and tears, too soon, too soon. There is a father scar made of terrible nights and resolution and a line of still green trees standing ornate as lace in a grove outside a medical school where my father gave his body, saying, my body for yours, a kind of atonement by tree. And I must admit in me there is a terror scar. It snakes so gingerly around my life entire, barbed and impossible to escape, a battered paper sack of oblivion I carry with me everywhere I go. But there are love scars, too, the most jagged of them all, where one child and another and another and another were born in fire and bliss, where the one whose eyes shone like promise embraced you night after night, sharp kisses holding impossible daylight at bay. Every one of them is a chapel. Every one of them becomes the religion of your life. We all make chapels of our scars.
Oh, Alice, I love that. That is so beautiful. One of the qualities of this book that I think appeals to readers is its intensity, in every way, intensity of action, of feeling, of language. It's as if you turned your whole poetic Alice self, to prose.
Yes.
So what was the writing experience of this like for you, so much to relive?
Well, the writing experience was twofold. On one hand, when I started writing this book, I was still very much in the throes of recovery from traumatic brain injury. And I had aphasia, very marked aphasia, meaning you have difficulty coming up with the word. It's like the feeling of having the word on the tip of your tongue times a thousand. Mm-hmm. And I had very halting speech and couldn't speak very fluently at the time. And so when I wrote, I would say in every sentence there was at least two and maybe three X's where a word I intended would be. I would just put it in as a place marker. And then I would have to Google to figure out what it was. I could see the image in my mind, and it might be something very simple. I might Google structure between two pieces of land over water, and I'd say, oh, bridge. So it was extremely painstaking. And in a way, I really taught myself how to write again by writing the book. The beginning of writing it was very painstaking. The other side of it was I wasn't entirely sure I could write a memoir. An agent that I had connected with very kindly said, you know, if you could write 50 pages of prose of a memoir like you do of a poem, I could probably sell a book. And I said, oh, of course I can, and then proceeded to try. But what I really did at the beginning was I thought of each chapter sort of like the scaffolding of a poem. Mm-hmm. And so that helped me write the chapters. And it was later that I went in and sort of included the narrative arc. And that's been one thing that's been just a pleasure to me, is early readers have all said, it's like a page turner.
It is.
And so that's really satisfying to me, to know that I succeeded in making something that makes you want to turn the page.
So tell us a little bit about where you are now, about what your life is like.
You know, I live in this little silly rental house with my three kids, and the thing that permeates our life every day is happiness. We laugh, we dance crazy, we talk, we cook, and it's just this ease that we haven't ever felt. My kids had never had that kind of ease and safety with nothing standing there to worry about or to feel threatened by. And so we've really arrived at that. And it's funny because, you know, we call it our finally. And every once in a while, we'll just be having a beautiful day. Who knows what we're doing? We were recently visiting a friend in a local Delta town called Locke, California. And Avery and I just look at each other and we say, finally. And it's kind of an acknowledgement that we've arrived at our finally. It finally came. It was slow going, but we sure appreciate every moment of it now.
Well, the reader appreciates it too when you get to that last page of the book. That's really a lovely moment, Alice.
Thank you. When I got my notes from my editor at St. Martin's Press, Nicole Argyris, there were very few of them. I was pleased. I thought, oh my gosh, I thought she'd have so much more notes for me. You know, as an author, that's your fear. Oh Lord, what are they going to say? What are they going to suggest? How much rewriting I'm going to do? I did rewrite the book, even though she sent little notes. But one thing that she said that just struck fear in my heart is that you need a new ending chapter. And for a good month and a half before I had to meet that next deadline, I went around telling all my writer friends, oh, I'm not writing a new last chapter. The ending is perfect. The ending is perfect. The day before I sent it to her, I said, let me just go ahead and go back and read the last three or four chapters. And I got to my ending, and even though it was triumphant, it was darkness. And I realized that was not the ending for us. That was not the story. The story was not prevailing in court. The story was getting to the point where we lived our happily ever after. And then I wrote just in a day that final chapter.
Alice comes into the light. I love it.
Into the light, always.
Oh, man. Well, this is a wonderful book. Nothing but good times ahead, I hope. We've been talking with Alice Anderson about her wonderful new memoir, Some Bright Morning, I'll Fly Away. Don't miss it. Alice, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Susan.
My
Mike Strecker has a pretty serious day job as executive director of university relations for Tulane University, but his second job, doing stand-up comedy, is all about going for laughs. And now he's put that passion into two books, The Young Comic's Guide to Telling Jokes, Books 1 and 2. And trust me, you'll laugh when you read them. Mike Strecker, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. Thanks so much.
Now, you've said that you come from a very funny family, so that's what led to all this?
I think so, yeah. My family, I had a large family. I was the youngest of seven boys. So, we were always cracking jokes, and I think that led to my comedy career. And I think what led to the books themselves is my wife. It was my family life. Of course, I performed comedy, and then I was in the habit of coming up with these little puns and these little one-liners just to kind of tease my wife. And she's the one that convinced me to put them in book form and package them, market them for kids.
You sure she wasn't saying, just give me a break for a while?
I think she greatly regrets.
Just a little bit right, of that,
right.
Maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, because after she convinced me to do it, I would come up with one and she would say, yes, that's good. Go write it down.
Like, yeah, right.
Preferably in another room, you know.
But you said all the jokes are approved.
She has listened and approved every one of them. And her therapy is going well now also.
So tell me why you decided to do these for young comedians.
Yeah. Well, it's strange. You know, I didn't originally think of them as children's jokes. And I was just telling them for fun. And I guess maybe I got a kid in me because I have always enjoyed these. But my wife, being a teacher, said, kids love these kinds of jokes and, you know, you need to write them down. And I did. And it was sort of at the last minute that I said, well, since I perform comedy, why don't I put in some tips to help kids if they want to try comedy themselves rather than just, you know, reading it from a book? And it was strange because it was a last minute thought. And the editor, she made that into the sort of focus of the book where it became not just a joke book, but sort of a guide to telling jokes along with, you know, a lot of jokes for fun.
I know. I remember when my son was really young, his great ambition was to grow up and be on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
And I think fall in love with Amy Poehler, but I don't, we didn't talk about that
right,
so much.
Right.
So just talk a little bit about that introduction. One of the things that appealed to me so much was that you said that for young comedians, they should never read their jokes, but they should read, read, read.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, reading is so important. A lot of people think a comedian is this kind of empty-headed person that does silly things or has crazy thoughts. But the truth of the matter is all the comedians that I've worked with, that I admire, and that who I've seen as a comedy fan, they're all very intelligent. They know a lot about a lot of things. I mean, they have this broad knowledge. And, you know, the primary way to get that kind of knowledge is you can't experience everything, but a great way to get that knowledge is through reading. And yeah, that's why I tell kids to read, read, read. It's a simple equation. The more you know about, the more you can joke about. You can't make any jokes about American history or American politics if you don't know anything about them.
And so much is about language and context.
Exactly. You know, 90% of them are based on puns, on cliches,
yes,
on the figures of speech we all say and hear. Yeah, it's so important. That's another tip is just be observant of and not only what you see, but what you hear and hear language and, you know, take it apart. And I think if you love language, it's like anything else. I've told kids this before. You love your friends, you play with them. You know, you love your parents, you play with them. You love words, play with them. Have a good time. Learn them. But after you learn them, play with them.
Well, pick a couple of jokes.
Well, here's one I like. When will the little snake arrive? I don't know, but he won't be long. I have a joke about what would happen if there was an earthquake at Mount Rushmore. Heads would roll. And, you know, a joke like that, you just hear someone say, you know, something happened at work and they'll say, oh, boy, heads are going to roll. And you sort of say, well, right, what if that literally happened? Where would heads roll? And you realize when you start doing this, all cliches and figures of speech, they're all ridiculous. And taken literally, they're just filled with comedic potential.
So what reaction have you had from kids with these books so far?
Really fun. You know, everybody's really enjoying them. I've had dads say, you know, they love to take these books with their kids on campouts and on car rides. And I think they're jokes that both the parents and the child can enjoy, which is really great. Because like I said, I never originally envisioned them as children's jokes, So I think there is an appeal to both the adult and the child, and the child and the adult.
And talk about some of the groups that you've chosen to categorize these jokes, because some things are just inherently funny.
Yeah, there are things that are inherently funny. Occupations are funny. Dentists, I don't know, there seems to be...
No, I think dentists are tragic.
Well, they are. But what they do, it just seems more funnier than a coal miner. I don't know. Yeah, there's certain things that are just funny. History's funny. The things that happen in history, whatever you elevate, right, is funny.
And food is funny. And food. Animals are funny.
Yeah. Occupations. It runs the gamut. It's strange. I wrote all the jokes and then I put them in categories. You know, I write all the jokes and then I say, okay, where are the patterns here? What does this fit? Sports are fun. There's so many cliches. Metaphors. Yeah. Get your head in the game, you know.
Heads will roll.
Heads will roll. Right, again. Right.
So when you were starting out, did you write all your jokes down when you were a young comedian?
Yeah. You know, it's strange because I'm very much of a writer. I never thought I would have the nerve to ever get on stage and do comedy, but I always admired comedians and enjoyed them. And I thought, well, maybe I could just be a comedy writer. And I was telling my wife the other day, I would have been totally content to write an act for someone and say, here, go do it. But that never presented itself. And stand-up comedy did. And it was a means to do what I, you know, something I enjoyed. Yeah, so I always thought that at the heart of what I do is writing. Obviously, I perform, but I wasn't one of these kids that, oh, I was always in plays and I can sing and I can play a guitar and I can dance. I can't do anything, but I can get on stage and talk.
But it's very different to do a stand-up comedy routine.
Yeah, absolutely.
Than to tell jokes.
It is, yeah. You're definitely not going in there and saying, hey, you know, what happened when the priest and a rabbi walked into the bar, you know? It's a narrative, and it's a story in many ways, and you're telling the story of yourself and your experiences, and when other people can relate to them is when the fun starts, when the humor starts.
So in addition to read, who do you watch? Who inspires you?
Right. You know, the comedians, I go back to my childhood there and staying up late and watching Johnny Carson as a child. And I like Johnny. One time I was on stage and someone said, you know, you have a Johnny Carson vibe. And I'm like, I'm not surprised. You know, Johnny Carson, I love Jerry Seinfeld. I was always a big Rodney Dangerfield fan. Maybe that's where I got my one-liners from. Don Rickles. You know, some comedians I've worked with, contemporary ones I really admire. Jake Johansson, he's a very intelligent comedian. I remember seeing him on Letterman and had a chance to work with him a couple of years back. I have a soft spot for almost any comedian because I know no matter how cocky or self-assured the person seems, they're just begging that someone's going to laugh when they're supposed to.
Of course.
And not laugh when they're not.
And boy, do I miss George Carlin.
Yeah, Carlin was, you talk about words. Yeah, he was a special. Real wordsmith. Yeah.
So how do you find the comedy scene in New Orleans for you?
Yeah, it's good. There's a lot going on. We still don't have a bona fide comedy club, I guess. We have some improv clubs and... But there's a lot of comedy activity. There's a lot of clubs that have a comedy night and are an improv night. For me, I'm getting a lot of private shows, you know, perform for this hospital group or this corporate group, Rotary group or whatever. So I'm getting a lot of those shows as well as some church shows. So I stay busy and I enjoy it.
Well, it would seem like we're a natural place for that.
Right, for comedy.
So many ways.
Oh, very much. Yes, as far as comedy fodder and material, I can't think of any better place in New Orleans.
Open your front door.
Right,
that's all
it takes. Right, and listen.
We've been talking with Mike Strecker, who's the author of The Young Comic's Guide to Telling Jokes, books 1 and 2. Take it on your family vacation or just keep it in the car. Mike, thank you so much.
Susan, thank you very much.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Michael H. Rubin signs his new legal thriller, Cashed Out, Thursday, September 7th at 6 at Octavia Books. If you love to read The New Yorker magazine, consider joining The New Yorker Reading Group. It meets every Thursday from 1 to 2:30 at the Rosa Keller branch of the New Orleans Public Library. Louise Penny and Trudy Nan Boyce receive the Diana Pinkley Prizes for Crime Fiction, Friday, September 8th at 6 at the NIMS Fine Arts Center, 4301 St. Charles. Penny is the winner for Distinguished Body of Work, and Boyce is the winner for Debut Novel for Out of the Blues. Tickets are available at Octavia Books or octaviabooks.com and will be exchanged for a copy of Louise Penny's new book, Glass Houses. Catherine K. Fontenot signs the Louisiana Urban Gardener Saturday, September 9th from 8:30 to noon at the Crescent City Farmers Market, 750 Carondelet at Julia Street. One Book One New Orleans hosts The Men in Orange, a book drive for Louisiana books to prisoners, Saturday, September 9th from 11:30 to 3 at Urban South Brewery. The Alvar Library presents the In the Garden Writers Workshop, facilitated by staffers Sarah Jacobelli and Henri Faroux, Saturday, September 9th from 2 to 3:45. The Dickens Fellowship of New Orleans gets their reading year underway with the first 10 chapters of Our Mutual Friend. That's Saturday, September 9th at 2 p.m. at the Bright Library at Metairie Park Country Day School. The North Shore's Big Fat Book Club is taking on Emma by Jane Austen this fall, starting Monday, September 11th through Monday, October 2nd, meeting from 3:30 to 5 at the home of Susan Blaylock, who facilitates this group in Abita Springs. There's a fee. For more information, email Abita Blaylock, B-L-A-L-O-C-K, at gmail.com. Ronnie Virgits discusses and signs Saints and Lesser Souls, the New Orleans Views of Ronnie Virgits, Tuesday, September 12th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Antenna, in collaboration with stationer Nancy Sharon Collins, presents the next in the Letters Read series, Regrets, an evening of live reading celebrating the written form of human rejection. That's Wednesday, September 13th at 6:30 at Antenna Gallery, 3718 St. Claude Avenue. Regrets is emceed by co-artistic director of Goat in the Road Productions, Chris Kamenstein, and accompanied by guitarist Rob Hudak. Letters include crushing job rejections, bombastic resignations, the letter from that insatiably cute boy who inexplicably broke up with you in sixth grade, expressions of loss or grief, letters of apology, of remorse, received, copied, never sent, notes left on windshields, nailed to trees, taped on doors, or snuck into bags. Darren Wang discusses and signs his novel, The Hidden Light of Northern Fires, Thursday, September 14th at 6 at Octavia Books. Room 220 presents the launch of Ecotone, a book of art and poetry by Benjamin Morris and Myrtle Von Damas, Thursday, September 14th at 7 at Antenna Gallery on St. Claude Avenue. This is the last week for the Hill Memorial Library at LSU's fascinating exhibit, Paper Tigers and Bibliobeast, featuring works focusing on the relationship between humans and other animals, as documented in the rare books, photographs, historical documents, and print materials in the LSU Library Special Collections. It's free and open to the public and runs through September 16th. For directions and hours of operation, visit lib.lsu.edu/special or call 225-578-6544. When the Southern Independent Booksellers Association meets here September 12 through 15th, one of the highlights is Read NOLA, which takes place Sunday, September 17th from noon to 6 at the Sheraton, New Orleans. It features authors Christine Baker Klein and Jocelyn Jackson in conversation, along with 17 other authors. Tickets are available at SIBA, S-I-B-A, web, dot, site, S-I-T-E, dash, Y-M, dot, com. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hillis Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org. Thanks for listening and keep reading.